I'm Gab, he's Jules. It's sunny blue skies over West London. And we have a packed show for you because the European club season is over and it ended on the high point with the Champions League final. Well, we got lots to talk about because we've got Zidane coming up later on with his open letter to the fans, Max Allegri to Juve, Brentford promoted, all this stuff. But let's start with the Champions League final. Chelsea winning their second Champions League. Nader Manua was joining us. Nader, I'm going to start at the top because I'm just going to dial it back a little bit and remind people that Thomas Tuchel came in with no preseason, with no transfer market, with very little, for a guy who's a super tactical manager, you move here, you move, we do this, we do that. Very little time to work on the training pitch. I think he had the most days off consecutively, excluding the international week when his players weren't there, before the Champions League final was 3 days, I think. And he goes out and he wins the Champions League final. He gets them into the top four. For all the talk of all the money that Chelsea spent, you know, you're still talking about Azpilicueta, who's 31, who has his issues. You're talking Rudiger, who didn't play in the first half of the year. You're talking Thiago Silva, who's 35 and out of contract. You're talking Jorginho, who supposedly nobody likes. You're talking Conte, who is 30 years old, coming off injury. People are saying he wasn't even fully fit for the final. You're talking Timo Werner, who can't finish. You're talking Kai Havertz, who only seemed to score it against Barnsley and Morecambe this season. I mean, this is what we're talking. You're talking Chilwell, who was in and out with Marcos Alonso at the start. And you're talking Reece James, who is magnificent, of course. Can we just show Tuchel some love? Because, yes, it is a very well-resourced team, but it's not his team, and he had no time to work, and he fixed what he could fix in double-quick time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think he was very, very impressive because when Lampard left, Chelsea did seem to be in some sort of disarray. I think they were probably maybe mid-table in the league. You couldn't really see how they were going to get out of it, but then Tuchel came in. He came in and made them very, very solid from the get-go. Like, I think it's fair to say they didn't score a ton of goals. But you could see that the way that he wanted them to play, it arrived very quickly and it got better and better and better. And even, as I say, they didn't necessarily score a ton of goals in doing so. They probably became one of the toughest teams to play against in the stretch when he was there. And then you add to that certain bits of individual brilliance which can exist within the system that he has. And it just goes to show, like, he's got a really high footballing IQ and he's got players who have that as well. Because they were able to buy into it so, so quickly to see the success and to thrive on it. You know, they were going into that game against Man City knowing that maybe they'd lost a couple of games recently, but they, once you see Chelsea and you see a Tuchel side, you know exactly how they're going to play. And the reason that is because they do it to a fault. This is their strategy. This is what they'll do. They won't start playing big diagonals because he doesn't want them to play diagonal balls. The centre-backs won't be playing long balls for the strikers or whatever, unless it's the thing that they've been told to do. But the players fully bought into it, and they could almost play blindfolded, whether that's in attack or defence. And I think that's down to the manager and the way he's tried to pass on that message to the players. And they looked so, so comfortable in that Champions League final because their jobs were, you know, they've done it 1,000 times before, even in the 6 months they've been there. And it was incredible. So credit to him for putting his vision out there with the team. And then, you know, for Chelsea, even though the players were underperforming at the start of the year, you know, Tuchel signed a way to get that little bit extra from them, and now they're champions of Europe.
I mean, he's such a demanding manager, isn't he? He's really tough. You see him and there's a lot of cuddles and kisses at the end, but even during games, he shouts a lot. He's very tough. He's very demanding on what he wants them to do. It's all about details. And I think he's done an incredible job. Yeah. We've said it already many times on the show, but in the space of 4 months, he arrived at the end of January. He now has beaten Pep Guardiola 3 times, and Jurgen Klopp, and Carlo Ancelotti, and Jose Mourinho, and Zinedine Zidane, and Diego Simeone twice as well. I mean, there's a way where you might not like the style because it's not attacking enough, or we can always find some flaws in people's game anyway.
And this is his style anyway, this is incredible. Because he hasn't had time to implement his style. I think he's like a firefighter who comes in and says, let me put out the fire, and then later I'll build you a beautiful house. All right, we got to get to Pep, though, because, you know, they had all this build-up, and the obvious thing, the obvious knee-jerk reaction, it doesn't make it a wrong reaction, Nader, is that he overthought this. He didn't play holding midfield. It's not the first time he's done it. We talked about it in the build-up to this. You know, we've seen Laporte at left-back. We've seen last year with Rodri and Fernandinho and Eric Garcia. And, you know, we've seen this stuff time and again. Is it as simple as that? He's overthinking things, and then this time he makes the decisions that he made. Or is that unkind?
No, I think people can be unkind. I don't think it makes that much of a difference to him because he has his ideas. But I think I have a slightly different view on some of this, because in the past, when he's been accused of overthinking things, he's been overthinking things in a negative manner. I think for the game on the weekend, he tried to be more positive by having an extra sort of attacking body in there. And because it's backfired, you know, it's easier to criticize, because then you start pulling the stats. Well, it's been this amount of time since they've had a Fernandinho or a Rodri and so on and so forth. But ultimately, for me, I think City didn't... I don't think City lost, because obviously Chelsea played their part and they were very, very good collectively. But I don't think City even performed anywhere near their best. There were probably four or five players who would walk off that field, who walked off that field for the game and thought to themselves, I've had a really bad game here. But some of those players were the ones who were in the positions which they've played for, you know, most of the season. So for Gundogan and so on, if you play Fernandinho, you play Rodri, Gundogan goes further forward. So he's somebody whose ceiling could be higher, because he's in a position where he can get in the box more, he can try and affect the game in a more positive manner. But as for other people, as I say, there were people who were on that field playing their normal positions who were having bad games. So we can say that Pep overthought it. But if the players, I think, overall would have performed just that little bit better individually, then we could have a better debate about tactics, because then you could see whether they worked or they didn't, but they never really had the chance to.
I'm kind of with Nadim on this one, Jules, in the sense that maybe they're all contributing factors. It doesn't change the fact that, to me, mentally, it looked like there was a bunch of people out there who were unprepared. The attacking output was close to zero. And we can credit Tuchel all we like, but this isn't what we expect.
Yeah, no, of course.
And it's not all just down to Rodri and Fernandinho not being there.
No, but it's too simplistic as well, because the expected goals were 0.23 in the first half. However, if you've got Gundogan higher up on the pitch with the proper holding midfielder sitting behind him, maybe it's a different story. The issue I have with Gundogan is not so much that Pep chose to do that. It's the wrong call, you know, and they lost the game. It's that for many weeks now, you've taught Gundogan to play in a different way. You've worked a lot with him and Juan Manuel to be a more attacking midfielder, far more of a number eight, even more in the box than anything else. And now you bring him back to somewhere he hasn't played since 2013. Yeah. And the other thing, guys, about Gundogan is you knew that Chelsea would play quick transition forward. That's what they do. They get the ball back and then very quickly they go forward. And you would think that to read those moves and to read that, a Fernandinho or Rodri, this is their job. Their job is to break the opposition's attack. And especially if it's a quick transition. So that's there. They read the game. They sort of anticipate where the ball is going to go. And that's what they do. That's what they break your attack. Yeah. The good one doesn't do that. Well, I'm still convinced, and I've watched the game again yesterday, I'm still convinced that had Rodri or Fernandinho being there in front of that back four, that goal doesn't happen.
All right. I want to get Nadim on this. Nadim, you got your finger raised, which to me means you got something to say. I'd like to break down the goal in a minute, but why don't you go ahead and weigh in now? No, I'm assuming you're going to react to Jules.
I was going to react to that goal itself, because having watched it back again, like, I understand what you're saying about having a six and breaking things up and so on, but for the goal itself, as far as playing football goes, like, you can have the idea and the strategy, but timing is everything. And they had something in play whereby everything, you knew Mendy was going to kick it to the wing backs. That was the thing which he was doing. Or the centre backs would roll it one way, and then you knew who was going to play the long ball. And I think Mendy kicked it up to Chilwell. And Kyle Walker's job was supposed to go, and the whole back line was supposed to go with him. But Kyle Walker left too late. So he caught himself caught in no man's land. And from that point, everybody else was too late. Zinchenko was too late on the other side as well. So from a timing perspective, it worked well probably 80% of the other times, and the attack didn't really turn out into much. But they got it wrong. I think the first mistake, in my opinion, was with Kyle Walker in terms of making the decision to still go, even though he knew he couldn't get there, because he'd serve no purpose in the move at all.
See, I think that's really interesting, and I'd love for you as a defender to break that down, because when I looked at it, I completely agree on Kyle Walker. I also think there was just a series of events where everybody could have made slightly different choices, and you might have have had a very different outcome. Because Stones also gets kind of stuck in the middle. Yep. He reacts very, very slowly. When the ball comes in, I realize Timo Werner is running, and Timo Werner made a great run going across. I'm not sure Ruben Dias needs to track across as opposed to maybe perhaps backtracking. Zinchenko... Mm. If you go back to the very beginning of the move, he's outside of Havertz, and he's very slow getting there. And finally, Ederson, I think he gets crazy. His timing all it's he gets crazy. His timing all wrong.
But for Zinchenko and Adam, I think Zinchenko is waiting for Ruben Dias to stop his run. And then in that case, both Havertz and Werner are offside. And for me, yeah. he's on the wrong side of Havertz because he's sure, he's convinced that Dias is going to stop his run. Werner is running, he's offside. Havertz is still yeah. running, he's offside as well. And yeah. and that's the only way for me why Zinchenko is wrong-sided of Havertz.
Yeah, I would see that. But I think that's almost like a secondary thing in itself because before that point, whether they were kicking it left or kicking it right, the whole back four unit would shuffle across mm. and be able to say, how many, like so many times when Mendy would play a ball to either the right wing back or the left wing back, the City's fullbacks were there to try and contest the header because they were there on time. And it meant that other people around them were in the right sort of slots. But for Zinchenko to be that far on that side, even if you're trying to have an offside trap, it's a very dangerous offside trap when you can't affect the person that's there because he can still hold the offside line from being on the other side, but he never made it to the right position, which ultimately, you know, that's you, in football sometimes you can be good and you can be lucky. And in that moment, maybe other times he's been lucky, but in that particular moment, he's in the wrong place and he got punished because as soon as that ball was on that side and Kyle Walker couldn't apply pressure where he was, and no other centre-back or no other defender could apply pressure for where they were because, you know, they were all on the back foot, then you're hoping that something goes your way, but it didn't go their way. And then Edison obviously tried to come out and affect it. And it wasn't good. And it's interesting because we talk about the six and the role they have in sort of stopping counter-attacks and so on. And maybe a six in there could have made a bit of difference. But the fact is, like, you look back at the game and there were three shots on target in the whole game for both teams combined. So even though Chelsea were good, their best players weren't their front three, in my opinion. You know, mm. I thought the wing backs were very good. I thought Kante was very good. And everybody else within that, they did their jobs really, really well. Like even tactically, say City can bring in, they could have brought in a six. But for Chelsea, from my view in the stadium, you could see they were just saying, play out wide, play out wide. City had false nines, eights, whatevers, but they couldn't get the ball to them because Chelsea's front three was narrowed to the point where City had to play out wide. And every time it went out wide to one of the wingers, you saw with Sterling and Mahrez, they had Reece James and Ben Chilwell on them straight away with a midfielder coming flying over. And if they ever tried to dare go through the middle, one of Chelsea's back three would be flying in there. You had Jorginho in there, you had Kante in there, you had the midfield three. And the moment City lost it, it was full speed ahead. So tactically, like, as I say, a six could change something defensively, but I feel like that wasn't Chelsea's like biggest thing because as we say, they ended up having two shots on target in the whole game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question, and I mean, there's a certain irony to the fact, right, that City's defense, which I think has been an absolute strength for them all season long, a chain event of mistakes and half mistakes ultimately leads to the goal. Other than that, you know, Chelsea had the Pulisic chance, which I think he definitely should have done better. And obviously,
for Werner.
And Timo Werner.
The two early on.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we're kind of used to. But it kind of shows, like, I think how good these teams were. I think we've also kind of forgotten that the pace that was set in the first half hour of the game, the way those two teams were going at it, there was just tremendous football,
yeah,
I thought.
It was.
I mean, really high quality stuff. I wonder, you know, Nathan, you made the point about the six. It meant ultimately, the six not being there meant Sterling was there. Football's also a game of individual battles. And I'm wondering if Pep's thinking wasn't, all right, let me put Sterling out there for those reasons, right? When the ball goes out, yeah, Chilwell and Reece James go out there quickly and somebody comes to help. But equally, I expect Sterling and Mahrez to take people on and beat them individually, at least a couple times in the game, right? And create an overload. Yeah. That didn't happen. And Am I giving Pep too much credit there? Did he see that as a potential key to the game?
Maybe he did. Maybe he did. I think to go to a late point, which I might come back on, I think after that game, there'll be certain people who left that field on Saturday and they probably played their worst game of the season. And it wasn't necessarily just because of the person they were up against. Because I've seen some players do certain things like even Bernardo Silva, there was a point where he was just dribbling, then he just kicked the ball out of play. And I'm looking at him thinking, well, that's not him. He doesn't do that. Like, what's going on? And it wasn't necessarily a tactical thing. It was just lots of little errors. Like, John Stones did a few things in the first half, which I was like, well, where's this come from? Because it tended to be unopposed. But I think in terms of Pep, like, on a different day, In fact, I'll say it now. The setup that City had is one which I've seen before, and I've seen them win and dominate games like that before. But this Chelsea side was trying to get everything to go out wide. But I think if City, if certain players would have had better games, then I think it's a different result. Because in my opinion, if City play well, they win the game. That's my opinion on that. Well, but they didn't. They literally didn't. So ultimately, as I say, when I look back at it, you know, I want to go into the real nuts and bolts of a tactical thing, but I can only really do it properly for Chelsea to give them full credit for it, because there were players on the field, in my opinion, say like a Mason Mount and so on, and you say Havertz and Werner and so on, who did a great job for their team tactically, but individually I think they could play better, but it wasn't required, because the most important thing was doing what they needed to do to stop City and make it difficult on the other side. But as I say, for City, there was nothing there.
Okay, let's take a bit of a step back here, and I'm wondering, Jules, if, and I'd love to hear from Nate on this too, is what you said about the individuals playing poorly. This is a very Italian thing I'm about to say, but we always talk about how, you know, the mental preparation, about getting the right tension in the players. The last meaningful game that City played before this one, and I'm not saying this to make excuses for Pep, it's an explanation, it's something that he might have screwed up. The last meaningful game that they played was, I think, May 4th, the second Champions League semifinal against Paris Saint-Germain. From then on, no matter what the manager tells them to do, they kind of know, all right, it's all about the Champions League final at this stage. Chelsea, on the other hand, they all had meaningful games, right? Every game really mattered. They lost some of those that mattered. Is there something to that? Like, I know you need to. The upshot is that obviously you've got everybody fit going into the final, which is great if you're City. But is there a different challenge then in getting the players into that right frame of mind? Did you guys know what I mean?
The last game Chelsea played was a week before. I don't buy that. Maybe there's a point. You can also say that the last eight clubs who played their first Champions League final in their history all lost it, which maybe is a sense of this such a big game with so much pressure and expectations and tension and everything you want when it's your first one as a club. I mean, not even those players, right, but like as a club, that there's something that gets to you, because eight in a row now can't be a coincidence.
Okay. Maybe it's not, but Nathan, 3.5 weeks without playing a meaningful game.
But that's not... But,
does that not impact
game?
You then?
What, the other games they play with no intensity or no pressure?
I don't know. I'm throwing that out. This is an excuse that we make all the time in Italy. It might be nonsense, right? It might explain why we haven't won anything in a long time. But is there something to that? Do you need a different kind of preparation? I mean, you've been there as a player, right? I mean, like when you've got a whole bunch of dead rubbers in a row and then a game that matters, are you in a different mental space? Or are you going to be like, no, I'm Mr. English Bulldog. I'm up there. I'm at a 9 out of 10 in terms of mental intensity and preparation every week?
Well, I don't know. I think there's obviously that conversation about, you know, not having reps in terms of feeling pressure. You know, you maybe going into the final, you wish maybe you had more, maybe like a Chelsea. But then the other side of the coin is, it's a Champions League final. Whether you hadn't played for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Like, my biggest disappointment as somebody who supports Man City is, as I was leaving that stadium, I don't know when they'll be there again. You literally don't know. Chelsea, this is their third final since Abramovich took over, and we're talking nearly 20 years ago. So there's no guarantee he'll ever be back there. So the motivation for the players, it should have been there, and I'm sure that it was, but their ability to perform under pressure for some of them just wasn't there, because these are guys who we've seen play this season, play some of the best football that I think I've seen in my lifetime. And they've been under pressure at certain points, because it's not as if they were top of the league for the whole season. You know, they had to fight to get back to that point. So then to see them, you know, obviously, as I say, they'd won the league a few weeks ago and so on and so forth. But, you know, they entered that stadium as favourites because of what they did to get there to this point. So to then be there and not perform anywhere near their best, you could argue that, you know, for Chelsea, it was another big game for them in what's been a tough month and so on and so forth. But, you know, for City and for lots of those players, barring, say, ones who've done stuff in World Cups and so on, it's arguably their biggest game for their careers. And what came before, even a Premier League thing in terms of feeling pressure, FA Cup in terms of feeling pressure, I'd argue this was bigger. Right. And they just weren't there.
I want to throw it forward to what happens next. But first, I want to give Jules is always a master at pointing out substitutions that were made, substitutions that were not made.
Yeah.
Jules, I want to ask you, when I saw Aguero come on, my thinking was, really? Like, is Pep superstitious now as well? Is there a bit of Disney inside Pep? Well, and was I being harsh? Was there any reason to put Aguero on the pitch other than this idea that he's the natural finisher and it's made for him? And
but for the last 10 minutes, you have to go. I think you have to go for it anyway. There's a risk that you're gonna you're losing that final.
Okay, so you have no problem with
no problem at all.
You know, well,
I think about substitution, by the way, and to go back to the debate we had about the number six, I thought once Fernandinho came on after 65 minutes, I thought City were a much better team, and to be fair, that's where they created the kind of half chances or whatever you want to call it that they had. But I think you had to go with Gabriel Jesus, right, and you had to go with Aguero, and Kevin De Bruyne wasn't there anymore, which I think was a shame, and I don't know what Nathan thinks about the Rudiger. I was going to say challenge or tackle. I don't even know how you can call the body check that happened. And there's people in France, for example, who think this is a red card every day.
Yeah, people in France think.
No, no, no. I'm just saying. Yeah, I don't know what Nathan thinks. I don't know what you think, Gab.
Would you have said
it was a red?
Okay.
But I think there's a place for that debate.
Nathan, if you'd been out there disguised as Matteo Lajos, which probably would have taken a lot of makeup and maybe less hair, but would you have sent Rudiger off?
Do you know what? It's funny. So I saw the game in the stadium. I've not seen a replay of it. So I can't. Unfortunately, I can't.
Thank you for your honesty.
Yeah, I'll say. Just for debate, I will say no. I'll say no, especially if this video and nothing came from that. I'm just going to have to say no.
But interestingly, right, Jules, I
need to say something to you, Jules, actually, because you were talking about the six and how they look better. And Fernandinho is obviously very, very good. But the game itself had changed at that point.
Yeah, true.
Chelsea could see the finish line. City could also see the finish line. And there's a case of one team being desperate to go forward and one team thinking, well, we have to just hold on to what we have now. So the dynamics were just that little bit different. But obviously, Fernandinho playing from the start, I think it would have helped the team because, you know, such a great leader and
yeah,
so on. But
exactly.
Honestly, the only player who I think would have benefited directly from Fernandinho playing would have been Gundogan, because other people were still in the exact same spot that they played.
Yeah, you're right. But I think that could have made a big difference. And also, and just quickly, because N'Golo Kanté, and you know he's my boy, and he's Paris born and bred, and he's a GOAT, and he's going to win the Ballon d'Or because France is going to win the Euro, so he's going to win Ballon d'Or. Anyway, I do think Nathan, though, that he had far too much freedom, Kanté, when you knew exactly the kind of runs that he's going to make forward, because that's why
that's
he doesn't need to hold. I think if Fernandinho had been there, I promise you, or even Rodri, I don't care, but someone there, and N'Golo Kanté could have made 2 yards and then over. He would have been like body check, like Rudiger and De Bruyne every time. And yet, there was not that presence for Kanté to limit the activity of Kanté in the game.
So every time he runs, and you look, and you know, ultimately, when he takes off, right, with all due respect, N'Golo Kanté, you know you're watching N'Golo Kanté, right? You're not watching young Aguero. So you know that the threat is what it is. Mm. But to have the physicality to snuff it out. I want to say one other thing about N'Golo Kanté, because this has been bugging me for a long, long time. 2 points on this. I tweeted this. N'Golo Kanté is a physical freak of an athlete, okay? There's no question about that. The stamina, the balance, the way he always stays on his feet, whatever. That's fantastic. But he's 30 years old now, and he's coming off an injury. The reason he was so great in this game has a little bit to do with his lungs, and it has mostly to do with brains, his own brains, his ability to read and anticipate, and the instructions that Tuchel gave him. And I might add, to all those people, and one day I almost want to turn like some freaking Torquemada and go and like and go and out people. Remember back when Sarri took over and the whole Muppet show of punditocracy, like, he's a defensive midfielder, what are you doing there? No, have him sit back and stuff, right? Can it be a coincidence that Sarri,
that
Lampard, and Thomas Tuchel all use him in this way? Where are all the people?
He played second striker, so
But you get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, definitely.
He played a certain way with Leicester because he's a certain manager played a certain way, but this completely unlocked his potential.
Completely.
And I'll be disappointed if at the Euros, and right,
don't
in fact,
worry,
I know he's going to do that.
Don't worry for us. Don't worry.
Your boy Didier Deschamps is going to go back. Well, I mean, given that he's going to play the 5-4-1 formation anyway, whatever. So I had to get that off my chest about Kanté. All right, does anybody disagree that Manchester City, notwithstanding the final, are the best team in the world right now? Okay, I'll take the silence as no. Okay, so now what I'm wondering about is next summer, and I want to get you, Nathan, because you're right close to it.
Yeah.
When Pep thinks about the football he wants to play, And given what we saw in the last 6 months, is there a center forward in there? And the reason I ask this is because they have resources. Aguero's going. And as I see it, they can either devote a lot of resources to bringing in a center forward who will share time with Gabriel Jesus or whatever, and they'll go back to playing with a central striker. Or he might just say, you know what? Let me not replace Aguero. Let me get maybe another forward, or maybe a mid-range forward, maybe a big dude or whatever who can play in certain games. But my base formation, my best 11 when I go and play most opponents, is going to be this version, obviously with a six, but is going to be the De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva, Foden, guys taking turns at center forward, strikerless, whatever way you want to call it. Like, do you think he's settled on that? And should he settle on that? Because that worked pretty darn well this season.
I don't think he's settled on that. I think it's a nice thing to have in your armory, but I think for City going forward, I think if maybe Aguero was fit throughout the whole season and he hit the ground running from the start, I think maybe he plays more this year. And they say they don't go to the false nine as much as maybe they did, but maybe lost confidence in him and just, you know, the fact that he wasn't necessarily always available. But I thought in the Champions League final, again, for context, it was later on in the game. But I thought Gabriel Jesus did very well when he came on and he was playing through the middle.
So that means he's going to sign a striker then?
I think it gives them an option which can sort of do better against teams like a Chelsea, because the way they were playing with the false nines, like a false nine, like, you can't really set and play and stuff like that, because it almost negates like a 10. If you get a 9, then your 10s can be better. And I think a KDB playing behind someone potentially is something which is quite exciting, playing off someone. And I think for Pep, that doesn't necessarily break away from the way that he wants his team to play. Because whichever 9 they bring in, I'm sure they'll have incredibly high footballing IQ anyway. But to be able to have a focal point as well, I think that ultimately will be a big thing for the team for next season.
Jules, I'm going to ask you the same question in an easy clippable format, right?
Yeah.
You can go for a big 9, Mbappe, Holland, Kane, or whatever, like a really high-end 9. Mm-hmm. Or you can go for a Gabriel Jesus standard 9. Again, very good player. And work something out there, but still have as your base, or go in with the plan that, depending on the opposition, I might go with the system that we saw in the second half this year. What do you do?
If you have the money, go for the big 9. You already have Gabriel Jesus. But, okay. Why do you want to go and recruit another Gabriel Jesus?
If you don't get the big 9, right? Because there's only, it is Mbappe, Haaland, Kane, right? There's nobody else.
And
they're all difficult for different reasons. If you don't get that, you would go for somebody, but you still have to bring in another body, right?
Or maybe you bring one of the youngsters like Delap, who's done really well and who can get some minutes in certain games in the Premier League.
But Delap is your new centre forward to replace Aguero.
No. That's not. But you see what I mean? You have Gabriel Jesus and you play with a false nine, or you've got Ferran Torres that has showed some good qualities in that position and you can work with him. Yeah. Plus a young Delap, for example, or someone like that. And then,
I think it's a big call to make. I think it'll be really interesting to see what he does. I mean, for my take, you go, it's almost like an NBA draft, right? In some cases, you go for the best player available. So obviously, if you think you can get Mbappe,
if you have the money,
or whatever, you get it. Kane, I'm not sure about. Not because he's not good enough, just simply because of the money involved. But otherwise, I kind of think get somebody younger or somebody who can, you have Jesus for that, an alternative to that. But maybe keep exploring what you're doing, because Foden's young, because De Bruyne is going to be motivated. Bernardo Silva's 26.
Nathan, would you sign Harry Kane?
I would sign Harry Kane, yeah. I'd go and drive down, pick him up from his house, drive him up to Manchester.
I'd do his washing. I would do his washing, walk his dog if he want anything.
Yeah, listen, what we need to make it happen. Just because Mbappe and Haaland and stuff, I think they're exceptional players, and I think they could do very, very well in England. But it gives me more confidence to know that Kane has already done very, very well in England from the get-go. And because he's more of to be fair, not compared to, say, Haaland, but he's got a physical element as well. So in the same way for City, you used to seeing them sort of pass teams to death and moving it and so on and so forth. It's also nice to know he could throw a ball into the box. Like when Kyle Walker was throwing the long balls into the box in the last 5 minutes of the game, I'm like, well, if Stones or Diaz don't head it, like, who's going to, what happens next? And that's just a desperation type call. Right. with someone like Kane, you're going to get 20, 30, maybe even 40 goals if he plays for this team.
I mean, I think it's going to come down to price and that. And it's as I wrote my column on Friday, I don't think Harry Kane has zero leverage in this. And ultimately, you know, there's a point, there's just in terms of cost, given Harry Kane turns 28 on July 28th, which is also my birthday, as you know. There's a point at which it just doesn't make sense for Manchester City to buy him. If you're going to be talking 120, 150 million, whatever, there is a tipping point where you still have to do your sums.
I know, but you can win the next three Champions League with him as well in the team. Do you see what I mean?
If you think,
he's not going to give you 10 years, so you don't think long term. Right. But even if
when financial fair play returns, you get in trouble.
I know, but there's no financial fair play this summer, so may as well go for it.
All right, just to wrap this on Chelsea, I'm assuming, I was looking at this. And before, when I went through all the flaws in the Chelsea team, I was being a bit harsh because obviously there's a ton of good players. But it seems to me that there is work to be done here as well. Because
in terms of the squad, you mean?
In terms of the squad. Yeah. And obviously everybody's focusing on the center forward and the fact that he doesn't like Tammy, fine. And Giroud, we presume, is leaving. Maybe it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to try to keep him around another year if you can't find the player you want. But I think there's work to be done at the back too. Right, there's talk of Thiago Silva extending another season. I hope he does. It's great to have him around. But, I mean, Azpilicueta, Thiago Silva, and Rudiger aren't going to be your back three. Christensen's been hurt. He's been in and out. They have Tomori, who I think is really good. May not have him at the end of the summer. I don't know.
Your boy
Kurt Zouma as well.
Reece James, who is seen as a centre back and as a full back or wing back, whatever.
But then you've got a whole right wing back.
But Tomori will be sold, right? You would think, and then they replace him.
I don't know. These are all the question marks that we don't have. What does Thomas Tuchel think of Tomori? He hasn't worked with him at all, right? We don't know. It just seems like there's so many moving parts to this, and that's before you get into the whole galaxy of attacking midfielder winger types. Both the guys who are already there. What does it mean for Ziyech? What does it mean for Pulisic? Yep. What does it mean for all the dudes for Hudson-Odoi? For all the dudes on loan, Barkley and Loftus-Cheek? I mean, it's going to be a lot of Wyscout watching this summer for Tuchel, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think in some ways, it could probably do with having another transfer embargo so he didn't have to make any big decisions. In this moment, to find success in such short term and then to know that he could potentially have money in the summer but then also have players coming back, like, these are some really, really big decisions because you've seen the team and obviously, as you said, they could bring in people here, there and wherever, but they've just won a Champions League, but the manager didn't have any say in terms of the players who were at the club at the time when he won the Champions League. So it's going to be so, so interesting. And I'll be interested to see what he thinks he needs to sort of do better, which positions he needs to improve when the money is available, if it does become available. And then who knows, will it actually make them better? That's the question.
I'll leave you with this thought. Thomas Tuchel, apparently, met Roman Abramovich for the very first time on the pitch an hour afterwards. And he says it would be a great time to meet him, or maybe it's a horrible time because it's going to be hard to keep this level, right? Just seeing him in such a good mood. Is this relevant at all? Or is it just a quirk of Chelsea that we had this image of the club where it's almost like a German club, right? The managers come and go, but like the impetus of the club isn't necessarily the manager. And maybe Thomas Tuchel's more expendable than anybody else. Like, he's never going to reach the status of a Pep or a Klopp, who are the boss of everything at the club, just about.
Yeah, and it's a short-term contract as well, which I think goes with your points. And I think he knows that, and I think he accepted it. He knows exactly how it works. He knows that, in many respects, it's a complicated club because you've got Roman Abramovich, who's there, but who's actually not there, hence why you only met him on Saturday. You've got Marina, who is so powerful, but also Peter Cech and Scott McLaughlin and others who are very influential in that club, but sometimes don't have the same idea and the same opinion. And I think he knows that, and maybe that suits Tuchel as well.
That's weird. I'm not going to ask you how many times you met Taksin or Sheikh Mansour. I'm assuming you hung out with Mansour probably about as often as our producer Freddie has hung out with Roman Abramovich. Yeah.
Well, there was one time where I met the actual Man City owner, and he was like, I was seeing like a god or some sort of like mafia boss or something. Because he was like, oh my god, there he is. the savior. He's changed everything. If it wasn't for him, we'd be in Division Two again, all that type of stuff. But yeah, it's weird. I kind of like the owners who you don't really see. It sort of adds to their power and their mystique. I've had owners which I see all the time, especially on Twitter, and I don't really like that. But for Abramovich and so on, they might change managers and stuff like this, but ultimately it's never too long before they find success. And, you know, credit to them for that.
Cheers, Nadim. Thank you so much. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, enough Champions League final for the next 12 months. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Jules, we knew that Zinedine Zidane would eventually give us his reasons for leaving Real Madrid. Now he has, and it was pretty much what we expected and what I wrote in my excellent column on the website.
Yeah, you're right. He wrote a letter to the fans, and the one really that I think, well, certainly the most important for me is the one that he didn't feel the support from the club, the backing, and you can say, oh...
And he went specific on that.
Yeah.
Those leaks that if he loses these games, he's going to be sacked and so on.
He's been there 20 years. So I think what's really key here is that he knows how he works. Of course he knows. He's a very intelligent guy. He knows he's been there before. But I think it shows you that there's a point where this is too much, even for someone like him, even for Zinedine Zidane, who is so strong mentally and everything. But even to him, they got to a point where he'd had enough. He's like, come on, please, let me work. Let me do this. And yet, it's the same thing. And it will never change. I don't think it will ever change. With another chairman, another president, whatever club in Spain, that's what they do. But I think it shows you that he can get too much.
Can I turn this around and take his words as a W for our profession? Because when Zidane comes out and says, oh, and then I pick up the papers and I read that I'm going to be sacked if I lose to Gladbach, if this and that happens, he doesn't take it as just paper talk. He doesn't take it as just paper speculation. He knows that those people who write for those papers in Madrid are doing their job. He takes that seriously. And he knows that that is information that they're getting from the club.
Exactly.
So, no, I don't want to hear about people who always just rubbish like the papers and the media. Yeah, there's a lot of people in our profession who write a lot of nonsense and some even make things up. And worst of all are the people who are very credulous about what people tell them. But in this case, if Zinedine Zidane, who knows the Madrid media, if he took those seriously, it means that those guys are doing their job seriously. And he has a point vis-a-vis the club.
I mean, on the other hand, if you're a Juventus manager and you hear your sporting director, Fabio Paratici is saying, yeah, he will be there next season. Don't worry. You know that it's not true and that you're going to be sacked very soon. So who's going to replace Zizou at Real Madrid, Gab? Three names for you: Antonio Conte, Mauricio Pochettino, although, you know, and Raul. Or is there someone else that you could think of or that you know of?
Look, I said this before, I'm on the record. I don't think Antonio Conte makes sense for Real Madrid at this moment in time. People are going to bring out, you know, I was on the show with my friend Phil Kitromolidis, you know, and he's saying, well, no, but a lot of people, actually, Real Madrid fans would love a Conte because they see him like Mourinho. Yeah, big difference. When Mourinho took over in 2000, I mean, many differences between the two, but when Mourinho took over in 2010, a year earlier, Real Madrid had the biggest, the greatest summer transfer campaign in history, signing Cristiano Ronaldo and Xabi Alonso and Benzema and Kaká and whatever else, right? So he had a ton of raw material to work with. Conte now wouldn't have that, and the $900 million in debt. So come on, man. Pochettino, I don't know. I think if I were Poch and Real Madrid call, sorry, Paris Saint-Germain, I'd figure out a way to get over there. Raul's on standby. Raul's on standby. You're buying time until the new calls Zizou again.
Yeah.
I would assume they're thinking somebody else. It's just a gut feeling.
Surely.
There must be somebody else.
Yeah, there must be. There must be.
Sticking with Real Madrid, the David Alaba deal is done. Jules, he's going to make nearly $150 million over the next 5 years. Again, off the top of my head, central defenders who make more than what he's going to earn.
No one.
Can't think of any right now.
No.
It's a big commitment for a guy who turns 29 in the summer. But we love him. We love him.
It's nothing to do with him.
No, it's not with him.
You and I would have taken the money. Everybody would have taken that money off it. But if you're Real Madrid, like, why do you think this is a good idea to offer that? I mean, I think the offer from... So this is 25 million gross a year. I think the offer from Bayern Munich to keep him was 16 million a year gross as well. So they offered him 9 million a year more than what Bayern were offering him. And you're like... And then you wonder why Real Madrid and Barcelona and clubs like that are in debt.
I mean, I think... All right, I'm going to defend Real Madrid here and be pay Mr. Contrarian.
Yeah.
First of all, and I'm also going to give you a free fact that we learned from our friend Kay Murray. First of all, David Alaba's mom is a former Miss Philippines, and David Alaba's dad is a Nigerian prince, which I think is really, really cool.
Okay, so that... Is that why he got offered so much money?
I mean, right. I'm going to assume they're cooler parents than
Give me your point then to stick up with Real Madrid.
No, but I think the point is, if you don't extend Sergio Ramos's contract, then you put him in Sergio's salary slot. If he then goes and extends Sergio Ramos as well, which I don't think he's going to do, but if he does...
This is not Sergio Ramos' slot either. This is more money than what Sergio Ramos was.
It's not far off. I think it's in the same ballpark. But you could see the logic there a little bit. If not,
I don't know. Let's not forget the signing on fee as well and the agent commission.
And
on
it's top of Gareth Bale still there.
Okay. Meanwhile, Max Allegri is officially back at Juventus 2 years after being sacked. Gab, before we talk about him, do you have a kind word to say about Andrea Pirlo?
Yeah, look, he went in, he tried. I think he had a good plan. His plan, he wasn't able to get it across to his players. Not everybody is suited to managing at that level when it's your first job.
Yeah.
What I think we're really interested in is which Max Allegri are we getting? Max Allegri is not wed necessarily to the football that we saw at the end of his tenure at Juventus, which, by the way, was very successful in terms of results.
Yeah.
Max Allegri isn't the kind of guy who, even though he has done this, who goes in a post-game press conference and says, like, stop talking about tactics. It's not about tactics. It's like in the NBA, at the end of the game, you just pass the ball to your best player and wait for him to do something. Like, that's not Max Allegri either. He said that. He's a pragmatic. I'm really curious. I hope he moves forward with Pirlo's idea and that direction of travel.
Yeah.
But the early indications for Juve are that Allegri wants to keep both Paulo Dybala and Alvaro Morata, although he's open to Cristiano moving on if that's what Cristiano wants. Does this make sense to you? Dybala's deal is up in 2022, so you have to re-sign him. And Morata would cost you $10 million to renew his loan at Atletico.
Yeah, I mean, if he likes Morata's profile, how much will it cost you if you let him go, to sign another one like him?
$40 million.
That's, probably.
You could sign Morata for $40 million.
It makes sense. I think Allegri knows that there's not much money for recruitment this summer anyway, unless you let someone like Cristiano go, and then that money that you save, you could reinvest it, which I think would be very clever. And for Dybala has had some really good years with Allegri at Juventus. So he knows how to use him. He knows how to get the best of him. So it makes sense that he wants to keep him as well. And then you can always talk contract, negotiation, and things like that. Giorgio Donnarumma is out there on the market now that he's leaving Milan. And there are reports that his agent Mino Raiola will now need to offer a discount. Gab, we called it. You certainly called it.
Yeah, as I said, like, this is me applauding Milan for sticking to their guns, saying, okay, we think you're worth this much. We offer you this much. Mm-hmm. The minute they did that, the minute Milan are out of the picture, all of a sudden the power dynamic changes.
Yeah.
Mino Raiola has to find a team, because whatever agreement in principle, whether it's Juve or somewhere else, now they say, hey, look, you're going to go to the Euros and it's going to say unattached next to your name. Let's make a deal. You take less money, less commission for you, Mino. My understanding is he's already gone back to Milan and said, hey, can we negotiate here? I know you signed Mike Maignan. And for now, Milan, I think, aren't going to budge. But later on, who knows? If you're Milan, if you can have both Maignan and Gigio, I know they can't both play at the same time. But
why not? Yeah, I guess.
Leave Mike in the lead for a season on loan. Let him play in the Champions League and then sell him, if that's what you want to do. Or sell Donnarumma a year from now. Who knows?
Sometimes you bluff and you don't always win.
Exactly.
Change is coming to the Champions League, Gab, after almost certainly scrapping the away goals rule. They also like the idea of a Final Four for the semi-final and final.
Yeah, the idea is have a whole week, whole Champions League week in a city. On Tuesday, you get one semi-final, Wednesday the next, and on Saturday, you play the final. Obviously, we would lose the two-legged aspect of it.
It would be a shame.
the traditionalists won't like it. Then again, it's pretty exciting. Like, if it drives it forward, I'm open to the idea, right? We don't have two-legged finals, right? Why should we have two-legged semifinals, right?
Well, you know, because it's home and away, and that's the beauty of it, like a quarterfinals. In that case, we go back to the old time when it's just, you know, you could do it over one game, and then that's it.
I want to see the plan. That's all I'm going to say. Jules, we talked about the next Real Madrid manager, and the bookies' favorites were Conte and Pochettino. Curiously, they're also the bookies' favorite for the Tottenham job. Tottenham Real Madrid.
Let me think. Yeah. Champions League.
No, seriously, who's going to manage that club? Well, we don't see any names linked in the papers anymore.
I don't know. That's why I think some of the stories that came out recently about Conte and Pochettino are maybe to buy some time and for the club to show, hey, yeah, we're still in touch. There's still potential. I think right now
are they secretly working on somebody else?
They must be. They must have other names because it's possible that Conte
is it
or Pochettino, but it's unlikely, right?
I don't think it's either one of those guys.
Whether it's unlikely or not, you need other names than just those two, Conte and Pochettino. So.
I mentioned Eddie Howe because he was linked to the Celtic job. Now, Ange Postecoglou linked to the... Yeah. I didn't put him in the quick hits, but Ange is a good guy, friend of the show.
The Wall Street Journal reported last week that Neymar's deal with Nike was terminated after he failed to cooperate with an investigation into the alleged sexual assault of a Nike employee. Neymar said it's a lie and that he wasn't given the opportunity to defend himself. Gab, this is turning ugly, right?
Yeah, it's an ugly story. It's ugly whichever way you spin it. We don't know the facts. You can read up on the facts. Yeah. Clearly, it was a very acrimonious split when he left Nike and went to Puma. Let's hope that we shed some light and some clarity in this for everybody concerned. Mm.
Meanwhile, Inter do have their new manager, Gavin Simone Inzaghi. Big shoes to fill, though, to follow up in Antonio Conte.
Big shoes, totally different personality. Massively. Simone Inzaghi, one of the soft-spoken, nice guys in football. He's the less
better
cool.
Better football, would you say?
Sorry?
Potentially better football than what Conte has been playing?
Depends what you think better is. Conte would say there's nothing better than winning.
Winning, true.
But, you know, plays three at the back. Fits it, and why not? Not as cool as his brother Filippo, but I think a nicer person.
Yeah.
But not that Filippo's
not nice.
It's good
for him. It's good for his progression.
It is good. Now, given Inter's financial situation, the buzz is that they will need to sell one of their stars. Everybody's saying it's going to be Achraf Hakimi, who's linked to Paris Saint-Germain for 80 million euros. Just, does this make sense or is it paper? It sounds like a lot of money, and it also doesn't quite... And Paris Saint-Germain have such a hankering for Hakimi, and you have that
so
much money.
So they need a right back. So they are actively looking for a right back.
He's a wing back.
Yeah, my issue is that he can't defend well. He can't defend. He's been a bit better with Conte as a manager and the way that he learned under Conte, but he's still much better going forward than defending. So it won't happen at 80. It might happen at 50, but yeah.
At 50, there's no point if you're doing it.
Exactly.
No point whatsoever.
Exactly. And Mauricio Sarri is strongly linked with Lazio now because of those musical chairs and everybody moving around. Good fresh start for him. Would you like to see him at Lazio?
I'd like to see the Sarri of Napoli at Lazio somewhere or somewhere anywhere. He's had time to think about it. It's going to be a weird relationship between him and Lotito at that club. But he's got some very good players to work with. And look, if he can find his enthusiasm, man. I mean, last time he was coaching, he won the Serie A title. Time before that, he won the Europa League. So what's not to like?
Yeah.
Matteo Guendouzi has reportedly found a new home in Marseille. Reportedly agreeing terms, but the club have yet to reach a deal with Arsenal, which seems kind of important since he's an Arsenal player.
Yeah.
Jules, what can Arsenal hope for? Some money coming in, or is it
just
another
money? Yeah, he's got 1 year left on his contract. He really wants to go to Marseille, and they're very happy with him. They wanted him on a loan. Instead, he went to Hertha Berlin a year ago. But
how much money can Arsenal expect?
10 million, probably, for Matteo Guendouzi, considering the potential, the age. I think with 1 year left on the contract, that's the valuation. Maybe they could hope for pushing a little bit with some ads on around 15 million. Not much. They bought
if
him for
Marseille,
eight.
If I'm Marseille, I'd offer a lot less. I'd go five and be like, hey, you guys screwed the pooch on this one.
Maybe. And he had a baby, by the way, him and his girlfriend. So congratulations to the Guendouzi family.
A baby of massive hair from the moment he's born?
No, not yet, of course. Yeah, okay. Italy have named their provisional squads for the Euros. And it looks like there's no room for Moise Kean, my boy, and your boy, Giacomo Raspadori. Why is Mancini taking only two centre forwards? Like, Ciro Immobile and Belotti, and that's it.
I don't know. It's an absolute mystery to me. And by the way, the two center forwards that he's taking, it's not like he's taking like Robert Lewandowski and his like clone Herbert Lewandowski, guys who are durable and whatever. Yeah. Belotti has injury injury concerns continuously. He doesn't score a lot of goals, but then again, he's playing for a very bad team in Torino. Immobile does score a lot of goals, but of course, they all come in bunches.
Yeah,
it's weird. It's weird to me. I hope he knows what he's doing. Maybe he watched a lot of Pep and he's like into the, oh, I don't need a center forward.
This is it. Yeah. You're not ready. Wait for Barella as a false number nine during the Euros.
There you go. Yeah, I don't think I need to see that. Peter Boss is on his way back. Look, Jules, see what we did? We went from Matteo Guendouzi to the absolute polar opposite of Matteo Guendouzi, which is Peter Boss. I think both roughly the same quality as managers, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Just one guy with a lot more hair.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm kidding, Peter. We kid because
we like you.
Olympique Lyonnais.
Yeah.
Good choice.
To replace Rudy Garcia. They're very excited. Very, very excited. Fans are very excited as well. Oh, Peter, he knows we like him, but that's sometimes because he messes things up pretty much every time, eventually.
What happened to Paulo Fonseca? Why?
I don't know.
This is Peter Boss.
I would have gone for Paulo. I think Olas wanted someone who speaks French. Peter Bosch played 3 years at Toulon when he was a player, so his French is really good. Maybe that was the difference. I don't know. I wish him good luck, and I think it's very good that you've got Pochettino, Sampaoli, Bosch in Liga next season as managers. This is great.
It's not yet two bald guys and one guy with big hair.
Yeah.
Maybe this is why Pochettino is leaving. He can be replacing with another bald guy.
No, it's
Duncan
okay. And
we'll have
Galtier stays in France for Nice, so we've got good managers. I think it's really good to have great managers.
And well, no love for Kovac?
And Niko Kovac, I forgot. So look, it's not as good as the Premier League, you know, with Klopp and Tuchel and Guardiola and et cetera, et cetera.
And Mason.
But you know, you've got Kovac and Galtier and Bosch and Sampaoli and Pochettino. This is pretty cool. This is very sexy. Staying with managers and going back to Italy, Luciano Spalletti will replace Rino Gattuso at Napoli. Gab, he has a very talented team, very, very talented. Should we pay closer attention? I'm not the biggest fan, as you know.
So Spalletti is actually a good manager. I don't think, you know, I've had debates with Inter fans about, like, oh, but you're being mean about Spalletti because, you know, obviously the wheels fell off and screws came loose in his head at the end of the time at Inter. And then they gave him that enormous contract, which is still paying off. But before that, there's a very good manager in there who comes out occasionally, right? He's done it. He's done it in different countries.
Yeah, but...
If he has the right mindset, if we get the, you know, Mr. Kurtz from Heart of Darkness, as I like to call Spalletti, and he ends up clashing with...
Which is very likely.
Aurelio De Laurentiis.
Yeah. It's a very special environment.
Not great, but I'm keeping an open mind.
Yeah.
Thierry Henry has joined our buddy Roberto Martinez. No, not Martinez. No English people.
No, please.
Martinez. Roberto Martinez. You can listen to True Live Crew for more education if you want a sense of how you pronounce his name. Anyway, he's going to join up with the Belgian national team.
Yeah.
George, this is good use of his time, right?
Rejoin even because remember he was
back
there.
Again,
yeah, back there. He was there in 2018. Good for him. He's waiting and trying to find a bench for next season. So at least you get involved. You still learn. You talk to players.
You hang out with players.
Exactly.
He's going to have better kickabouts with them than he would on the beach wherever he was going to go.
Big time, you know, rondos and kippy-uppies and everything you want. Finishing work with Romelu Lukaku, Dries Mertens and the others. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. So
I want to. Like,
and also, if they win it, he gets the medal.
Now, look, this is not why he's doing it. Listen, Thierry Henry, I know he turned some people off or whatever. I like him a lot, and I think it says a lot when people are willing to go and work. I don't know how much money he's making here, presumably close to nothing by his standards.
So.
He's doing this because he wants to continue to learn and improve himself and put himself back in the market. So credit to Thierry Henry.
Yeah. Jerome Boateng, Rui Patricio, Granit Xhaka. Just three of the names that have been linked with Roma and Jose Mourinho, Gab. What does this tell you? And this is funny, though. Sergio Ramos? No, Sergio Aguero?
I think, what it tells me is that, you know, everybody has Jose Mourinho's phone number and everybody has Jorge Mendes' phone number. And so, hey, look, you know, anybody we want to move, why not? I mean, if you're Rui Patricio, right, you've been there, you've been good at Wolves for several years, your manager's leaving, hey, look, let me go try something different.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that this isn't the direction it goes in.
They need talent as well, yeah?
What?
They need to try to buy players with talent.
They have Zaniolo. They have David Zaniolo. You don't need more talent than that.
Yeah, true.
You have the ninth king of Rome after, since Totti was the eighth. No, look, I don't know. I think inevitably you're going to get a lot of paper talk and a lot of attention when Mourinho's there. I'm hoping that Boateng maybe get another season out of it, but is this what you need? I mean, I think defensively, you know, you've got – they weren't very good defensively last year because everybody was injured. But, you know, you've got Mancini, you've got Chris Smalling, you've got Kumbula. You've got players there who can play, right? So let's use that as a starting point rather than just linking everybody to the team. They do need a goalkeeper, though.
No, that's true.
Brentford win the promotion playoff and will be in the Premier League next season. Jules, they may be a mile away from here. This journey is pretty incredible. It's a club we're both very familiar with.
Yes, we like them a lot. We know people who run this club and they've done an amazing job. They've got good ideas. It doesn't always work, but certainly the way they run their club is the way it should be. And well done to them. They've been fantastic. Well done to that squad, the manager, even losing their best players last season, like Ollie Watkins, for example, or Saïd Benrahma. They still managed to get the promotion that they didn't get last year with
them. You get that dude, Ivan Toni from Peterborough, and he scores more than those other two guys.
Who's been amazing. So everything in terms of their recruitment, scouting, working the community, the new stadium, all of that, well done to them, and we can't wait to see them in the Premier League.
Can I cite an inspirational quote from their owner, Matthew Benham?
Yeah.
I don't think he made this up. I think he copied it from somebody, but he lives by it. He said, when you've got fewer resources, you can either try to do what everybody else does and try to do it better than them, but that's really difficult because you're under-resourced, or you try to do something different.
Exactly.
They've gone, they've done different types of things, they've struck their own path, and it's finally paid off.
Also pretty incredible, Gab, is the story in Italy where Venezia are also back in the top flight.
Yeah, via the playoffs. It's pretty remarkable. I think there's, as far as I know, the only top flight football club whose stadium, in addition to being derelict, is on an island and you get there by boat. It's a wonderful story. I don't know how good it is, to be honest, for Serie A, other than the novelty factor, because, you know,
compared to a bigger club, you mean? Had the bigger club gone up?
Yeah, it's a big name club. The stadium is what it is. But then again, you know, in the end, they were playing Cittadella in the playoffs, where like the second team from Padova. So, yeah. I mean, this is the reality. One of the weird things that's happening in Italy and in Spain and Germany, certainly, a lot of historically bigger clubs are going down and staying down, and we're seeing all these little clubs come up. But Venezia, I mean, come on. They had their celebration parade on boats, on gondolas, on the Canal Grande. Who's going to beat that, man? All right, that brings us to an end for today. But we got to come back Thursday and do this all over again,
stop.
Right?
We're on a run. We can't stop.
Oh, my God. And we got some Euro 21 love, too.
Yeah.
Game kicking off in a couple of hours. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.